Hey guys, welcome to the HYM podcast. On HYM, we'll be talking about all the aspects of motorsport, from four wheels to two and everything in between.
Yeah, so we've created this podcast to give a real insight to everything motorsports, and that's two wheels and four wheels, and what we're all involved in as well.
Yeah, all three of us have competed in professional racing for a while now. Two of us on four wheels, one of us on two. And yeah, we feel like we've got a good stories to tell, good amount of stories to tell from people we met over the years, and we feel like we'd want to bring that to your screens a little bit. So yeah, I'm Jake. I've competed in all aspects of junior racing below Formula One, and I've just started to go into the professional racing scene now.
Yeah, so I'm Alex. I'll be one of your hosts and producers on this podcast, and I've raced in world championships in Supersport 600 and 300, European championships, and I was British Junior Cup champion in 2015.
I'm Nick Yellerly, a professional racing driver for BMW Motorsport and sim and test driver for Aston Martin Formula One as well. Like Jake, I've come up through the junior ranks and now, yeah, driving GTs at a professional level.
Yeah, so don't worry, this won't be just one of those normal lockdown podcasts that everyone's sort of created, but I think it kind of is, isn't it, boys? So yeah, so
nothing better to do,
so
I'm
yeah,
not hiding that one.
There's going to be lots more content coming with this channel through the year. You know, we've got plans to grow the channel and grow what content we can create through 2020, and hopefully when the lockdown restrictions are lifted, we can be doing some more fun stuff with you guys. But yeah, so let's crack on with today's episode.
Yeah, on today's episode, we've got someone who's very special indeed. He's competed, I've raced him in 2013 and 2014, before he's then gone on to race in GP3. He's competed in Daytona 24, and most recently he's been a factory driver for Bentley Motorsport in the world of GT3 racing. And the best thing on that list, or I didn't mention on that list, was that he was also a Jack Wills model. Mr. Seb Morris.
Thank you for having me, boys.
You're good?
Yeah, very, very good. Yeah. Just getting ready for the season. Obviously, it's been shaken up a bit. So working very hard to try and get back out on track.
Yeah. What's the plan for this year? Yeah. What's obviously it's been a bit of an up and down 12 to 15 months, I'd say. So what's the plan for this year? What's it looking like?
It's obviously the plans changed quite late on. Obviously, coronavirus seems to have made everyone struggle, and it's definitely pushed the season back. So luckily, it gives me a bit more time to try and do something. For the people that are listening that don't know me or what I race, I race for Bentley in GT3, and unfortunately, they decided that wasn't the path they want to go down anymore. So all the drivers were told, you know, you're free to go and find something else. But my plan is to actually stay in a Bentley in some capacity. Bentley as a brand still would like me to be involved, and there's lots of customer teams that still want my services that are still actually racing the car despite Bentley pulling out the factory money. So I'm working on a couple of things there which could be quite exciting. And I think this year is just going to be about survival, really. I think you've just got to keep your ass in a seat and hope for the best, because you know things are going to improve in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. And obviously, having raced each other a bit as a fellow factory driver, but for a different manufacturer, yeah, you can see every little aspect of each manufacturer has been squeezed just because of the pandemic. Budgets are being cut, hence why probably Bentley were pulling out, simply because they've been, you know, cut already. So yeah, like you say, to be able to just stay in the mix is actually a privilege already, because a lot of people will be really, really struggling to get budgets together or even to get those drives, you know, top high quality drivers. Even, you know, with the DTM finishing as well, which is the highest level of GT racing, technically, you've got all these people flooding the market and a lot less seats to go to. So it's tough for everyone, but I'm sure you'll come out the other end with a better you know, gig than you had beforehand, mate. So I wouldn't worry too much.
Yeah, and you know, just on the Bentley thing, it actually their pullout was not. I think coronavirus sped it up, but I don't know if you've seen, they want to announce that by 2026 all their cars will be made available in electric and hydrogen, ahead of the government's rule by 2030. So, to be honest, it doesn't really, GT3 racing doesn't really fit in with their brand promotion and what they want to push from motorsport. So they're having to think about what they can possibly do in the future, and there might well be a future there. So that's why I want to keep involved in the brand and just try and keep helping the brand and the customer teams out for the time being.
Well, I think we still don't really know, do we, like how motorsport's going to look once the pandemic's finished. So I think, like you say, like keeping your bum in the seat, so to speak. I mean, a lot of people are going to fall by the wayside. A lot of teams and manufacturers probably going to pull out, which unfortunately happened with Bentley in this case. And I think as much racing as you can get on your CV in the meantime, it's only going to help you when it all sort of settles down and we see sort of what the market looks like. Cause like you say, maybe, I even saw with DTM that they were thinking about running a electric series in the future or sort of hybrid series. And, whether that happens, we don't know. But if it does, you've got to be around for it, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and especially if this LMDH thing takes off, which I think it will, to stop racing in the next this year or next year is going to make that basically impossible to be able to do that. So as I said, this year is about keeping my bum in a seat, keeping my name up there, try and win some races and keep my name in the fold for when something does happen in the future.
Yeah, completely, man. And you touched on the LMDH thing. Is that something you think Bentley would do just so they could go back and try and win Le Mans? Because obviously they've won it outright quite a few times. Or do you think now that they're completely solely focused on making all their cars electric by 2030, it's not going to happen?
Yeah, well, this is just my opinion, but I think it would make sense. I think it would be a great story. It would be 100 years since they first won Le Mans. If they were to go and try and do it in 24, 25, or one of those years, so it would make a great story. And the reason why GT3 doesn't work for them is because it's not sustainable, and it's not what Bentley have realised that they want to be the first luxury manufacturer to be able to become carbon neutral and become efficient in the way they produce cars and the way the cars run on the road. So I completely agree. GT3, you look at it, it's a bit outdated now because you've just got big V8 engines, no hybrids, no nothing, and they're not that economical, are they? They do about 3 miles to the gallon at best. So
no,
I can understand. So in answer to your question, if I was on the board, it'd be something I would want to look at for sure.
That's got to be something that they got to look at. I think the rumours that of the amount of manufacturers that are going to join up and do that is mad. I mean, you don't know if they're all concrete, but I've heard basically anyone who is anyone in the manufacturer world are definitely putting proposals together to the board at least just to see if they can do it.
It's not stupidly expensive either, is it? If you look at the budgets, compared to what people used to spend, we're spending 200-300 million quid. It's nothing on that scale.
Yeah.
No, exactly. I mean, DTM compared to DTM Class 1 regs, or Formula E, the budgets they're going to be capped, but for the moment they're very, very expensive. If you look that you can go and win Le Mans outright, you can go and win Petit Le Mans, Sebring, Daytona, all with the same car. So you can use it in so many variants. And then judging by what IMSA have done as well with the GT Pro thing, you're going to be able to race your GT3 car and your roof.
I think it depends on what the regs of these series kind of come out with in the future. Because motorsport is just a marketing tool, really, isn't it, for brands like Bentley?
Yeah, motorsport is marketing at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I would always associate a race like Le Mans with Bentley. And I think if the regs fit and it suits what they're trying to do with the mission statement and what their road cars are going to be in the future, then why not, kind of thing, I would think.
Yeah, well, hopefully, anyway.
Well, it would suit you.
It would suit me, yeah. you mentioned at the start, obviously, I've done Daytona and with my relative performance compared to other people and teammates, Daytona was by far my best performance, in my life. And that's not just in terms of, because we didn't get the result because we had technical issues. But, I'd found that style of car and the way it was designed and the aerodynamics and the way everything was just very simple. You know, you have no ABS. You know, it's just you and the machine and 850 horsepower and load of downforce, and that seemed to suit me rather well. You know, more than GT3 does, to be honest. I mean, I'm not bad in GT3, but you know, there's Jules always pulls a tenth on two of me in qualifying, but I wouldn't say anyone would be able to do that in one of those. So if you know, if LMDH is any, you know, vaguely similar to that, then that would excite me greatly.
You in the Cadillac?
Let's talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Cadillac DPI, right? In the DPI.
Yes. Yeah. So when the new shape came out in 17, basically, so when everything changed, you know, from the old prototype, the old DPIs to the now new ones.
Yeah. Oh, let's talk about that.
Racing, wasn't it?
What'd you say, Nick?
I said let's talk about that change a little bit from single seated over to GTs, because it's obviously something that I've done. I found it quite difficult as well. So from relatively high level single seaters, jumping over and trying to make the transition, particularly for the first year and a half, 2 years, I felt quite alien. And still sometimes now, anything I jump into with more downforce, I feel immediately at home, even though I've done since 2016 in with a roof over my head. So is that something that you feel the same? You just feel much more natural and at home and comfortable with that extra power, grip and downforce because you've done it previously in, you know, the rest of your career? Or is it just that your particular driving style, having worked with you and actually done some driver coaching, I know you're relatively aggressive with the old wheel, so it just suits you better.
In answer to your question, I think it's because I've spent so long with downforce and, you know, a lot of power. Even something like GP3's got relatively, you know, good amount of power, and then you know, some good downforce despite the tires. But you know what I loved about the DPI when I raced with Action Express was that you have all this downforce, all this power, but you can come out corners sideways because the tires were so amazing that, you know, they don't really drop off, and that just seemed to suit me down to the ground. And the only thing that's really hampered me, and that's why I was rubbish in GP3s, because at the time I raced GP3, I think this was even before Hughesy's time.
Before it was.
Yeah. So at the time I raced, you know, we were racing 10 to 12 seconds off what we were qualifying at. You know, it's ridiculous. So you know, the with the Daytona stuff, that's why that suited me down to the ground, because as Nick said, I'm very aggressive with the wheel. I always have been. I do like a hustle. And it was a car that, you know, appreciated a driver with confidence getting in it and throwing it around.
Yeah. Who were your teammates in that Daytona race, by the way?
So I had Mike Conway.
I was going to say, I thought it was Mike.
Yeah, Eric Curran. And I don't know, who's the other one? I'm trying to think who the one was. It'll come back to me.
Mike's a good benchmark, though, isn't
he? Yeah, one of the best.
He's my brummy.
Yeah, Mike was really good, and someone I really enjoyed working with working from. Dane Cameron was the other one, sorry.
He's Acura Factory, though, right?
Dane Cameron, Eric Curran, and myself, which was a really strong lineup, and we were leading the race for quite a bit until we had some water get into the airbox in the night, and then that basically put us out of the race, which is disappointing because I was only young, and I was coming around this bank at 200 miles an hour and saw number 30. You know, it was really weird because number 31 was my race number, always has been, and that was their race number as well. So I was coming around this bank like 210 miles an hour and saw number 31, you know, P1, and I was just absolutely dropping Jeff Gordon. I was like, this is sick.
Have a bit of that, son.
I think
How did that come about again?
I pulled 46 seconds on him in an hour.
Only a little just bit drop, then.
Just drop that there, yeah.
Yeah, send that.
How did that come about again? Getting into that.
So there's this challenge called the Sunoco Wheeling Challenge, so it's just the Sunoco Challenge, I think, and that they basically amalgamate the points of all the championships in the UK. You can be racing. It's quite cool because you can be racing a Mini or a Bentley, you know, in British GT, and you know. someone in the mini challenge can be getting poles and wins and fastest laps all the time, and that can be beating you in this Sunoco championship because he's smashing the poles and the wins. Because you get points for pole, points for wins, obviously, points for fastest laps, points for laps led. So it's this really cool system where it makes all the points of all the different championships across the UK the same. There's a lot of, I think F4's entered into it now, F3 in the UK. So there was all these different drivers at massively different levels, but basically because they make the points the same, essentially, whoever actually does the best in their individual championship or against all the other people in all the other championships will win the prize. And I won it and just beat Phil Keane. And because I won the British GT Championship in 2017 with Bentley, and, you know, we had so many poles and so many wins, and I set a lot of lap records that year as well. So that counts. So it was a good year, and that's what gave me that prize, which is worth about £250,000 if you were to go and pay for it.
Yeah, a minimum, particularly now.
Yeah. Could you imagine though going from a mini to that DPI at Daytona?
Yeah, I mean, it's not happened, someone coming from really low down, but I think someone in the last couple of years won from GT4 in British GT and went straight to that. And I think that was a bit of a shock.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. Big racing in the night with likes of Mike Conway coming past you would wake you up a little bit.
Yeah.
So how did you get into racing though, mate? Because I know a little bit, but obviously, like, tell the people listening how you kind of got into it.
Ever since I was like 2 years old, I was absolutely obsessed with anything with four wheels. Unfortunately, not two. But only four. And when I was crying, when I was like 1.5, 2 years old, my parents used to just give me the keys to their car and just go and sit in their car for like 2 hours and be happy as Larry, just pretending I was driving. And no one instilled that into me. That was all driven by me. My dad said, you know, you get a lot of these pushy dads forcing their kids into racing and whatnot. And my dad wasn't interested. But, you know, he watched a bit of Formula One, but only really started getting into racing once I was in it. And I had a go-karting party when I was 8 years old, standard for my birthday. And I lapped all my friends like three times and actually set the lap record at the local track for, you know, the under eights or whatever category it was. And the guy at the track said to my dad, oh, I presume your son's a professional. And my dad said, what are you talking about? And mum was there as well. And he took my mum and dad aside and said, look, you know, your son's got this innate talent. If you're saying he's not done this before, then you need to take him. You need to take him here. So we went to Ceredigion track in Wales. I got my ARCS license, bought my first go-kart, and then, you know, they said I was very good considering not done any driving. And we used to rock up to races in Super One we had our car, and we just put a trailer on the back, and we had the worst go-kart on the grid. And I won't name the name, but it started there. So I went from lapping my friends to my first race. I think I got lapped three times. So that was a bit of a shock. But then the year after, I was winning championships when we got into a zip cart and had, you know, we realized that you had to tune engines to go quickly and get them tuned. So yeah, it started from there. And then obviously just got absolutely hooked. And it was me, mum and dad on this little journey. And I haven't stopped since.
Yeah,
I said it's cool. It's so many different little stories, but it always starts with a little kid just saying and nagging their parents, because it was the same with me. I was a bit older, maybe 14, 15. I think, Jake, you were pretty similar in terms of age when you started. So older than
15, 16,
let's say. Yeah, exactly. I think it was, 2 months, September 2005 or something I started. So I was just before I was 16. And it's all that nagging, because I wanted to do it. And my dad liked cars, as I know your old man does as well, Seb, with his nice cars.
Yeah, he likes cars.
It's all stemmed from that, really. So it's their fault for having those on the drive when we were younger, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. He's always been into his Porsche, so I used to go and sit in them. But I used to be obsessed with, my mum's always had Range Rovers, and I used to be obsessed with going and sitting in a Range Rover all the time. And I remember... You know, because my dad wasn't very mechanically minded, but he actually is now he's learned. I still remember him shouting at me when I was about 5 years old. We were in Cheshire Oaks shopping, and I just said, I'd rather sit in the car, apparently. And I was like doing this with the accelerator. My dad goes, don't do that, or you flood the engine.
oh, Oh man!
You then went into like Genetta Juniors, didn't you? After karting.
Yeah. So basically, I only ever did lower level karting. I did a couple of rounds at Super One, and I think my best ever result go karting was I came second at Shenny once in Super One. I've never won any championships, you know, on a national level. I used to win, you know, the local clubby championships, and I sort of got drawn into that and just did a load of that. And then when it was at Super One, it was dads beating each other up. I mean, there's, you know, people swearing at my dad, and my karting manager Tony Theodore was brilliant. He taught me everything I know. And I remember, you know, someone started on him and him shoving someone up against a van, and we all just thought, you know, this is ridiculous, you know. And it was just so high pressure, and you had all these dads fighting all the time, and everyone was cheating left, right, and center, cheating with the engine, cheating with the exhaust. I mean, we caught some pretty big names out doing it. Tony had a very, very good eye, so, and a good ear, so, you know, you could hear if someone was double wadding the exhaust and stuff like that. And we just thought, we saw this advert for Genetta's, and we went to the Autosport show, and I met Lawrence Tomlinson, and all these really fit grid girls that were there as well. And yeah, so we did that, and then we just decided, you know, we didn't realise that you could race that young. So I was 14, I forgot to mention. I had a test, I've missed a major part. I had a test at Pembrey when I was 13 years old in a Formula Renault, and they had to make four seats to fit me in. I was that tiny. My name was Seb Smallboy Morris because he used to be so small. I don't know when I grew.
That's what they call you still though, don't they?
Yeah, that's when I'm lying down now. So I had a test in Formula Renault when I was 13, and I was only like 2/10 off, you know, the pace. So I thought, right, let's go and do this instead, because I realized once I had this test and spoke to this team Hillspeed that they were, you know, I was talking about these names that I thought were huge in go-karting, and they just didn't know who anyone was. And I thought, hold on, you know, everyone's in this karting bubble, you know, and you can be world champion in karting and people in real racing still won't know what you are, or who you are. So I thought, right, let's do it. So we went to Genetta Juniors at 14, and I got a couple of podiums in my first year. It was a massive, massive learning curve, but it was the best thing I've ever done because it put me 3 or 4 years ahead of everyone else immediately, because I was doing that at 14. And back then, people weren't coming out of go-karts till they were 16, 17. So it put me massively ahead of the curve. Then the year after, I won 11 out of 20 races and got 17 out of 20 podiums. And the other three races, I came fourth. So it wasn't a bad year.
Yeah, you went into Formula One after that, didn't you? Because I remember 2012, end of 2012, I can't remember if you'd done the main season or not, but I did the winter series,
yes.
BARC. And I just remember like this cult of Seb Morris like following. Like you were the boy of UK racing at that point, like junior racing.
I did feel like it. I felt like those were the years of my life, and you know, when there was we were 2012, we won loads of stuff in Formula One. We won the winter series, came third in the championship because I would only ever win a race or throw it off. So it was one or the other. And I think that's what the fans and stuff loved about me, because they, you know, at Silverstone, the last race of the year, there was something stupid, like 42 cars on the grid. You know, that was when it was at its...
Yeah, I was in that race.
Yeah, it was mad, wasn't it?
I was on the national circuit.
Yeah, on the national circuit, 42 cars. I remember I qualified pole for both races, got both fastest laps and won both races. But the weekend before, I came 18th because I kept throwing it off at Thruxton. So it was literally one or the other. Yeah. But, you know, it's amazing how you mature as a driver, because I'm not like that anymore. In fact, I would say I'm possibly a bit too conservative nowadays, especially when that, you know, I know we're jumping a few steps, but, you know, when I signed with Bentley, you know, the pressure of driving for a manufacturer and knowing that, you know, you'd no longer pay your own damage bill, you know, so instead of my dad shouting at me, it's now, you know, Malcolm Wilson, you know, or Paul Williams shouting at me. And that pressure is, you know, I don't know what you think, Nick, but when you start driving for a manufacturer, the pressure of not actually damaging the car is a lot higher.
Yeah. For me, yeah, it's a big old change in it. I was lucky that I got sent out to China my first year with BMW. The main factory thing I did that year was the Nordschleife, so I was sort of just thrown in, no expectations, and did quite well. And also, I'd say my change, obviously, I'm a little bit older. How old are you now?
I'm 25 now, so I'm cracking
25. On. Yeah, well, I'm 5 years older, so I'm the big 3-0. And by that time, I'd already done like a few Formula One tests and stuff like that. So the pressure wasn't quite as apparent, because there's nothing like jumping in your first F1 test and the chief engineer going, yeah, well, we haven't got spares, so just make sure you go fast, but you don't crash it. I was like, right, okay, mate. Yeah. Okay, yeah, thanks. Okay, sorry.
The pressure!
Yeah. Just shaking as you're going out the garage. And ever since then, I've never really felt it.
It's 300 grand for a front wing.
Yeah, exactly. But I completely get, because when you have these big events like Intercontinental GT or the Nordschleife program, you have the whole team. It's not just, you know, the big bosses. It's all these race engineers that you've worked with and the performance engineers and the media people all watching you. And they will know as soon as you've made a mistake. And it's just that pressure that you don't necessarily think of while you're out there, but before and after, it can wind you up in a good way or a bad way, depending on if you've dealt with it a lot before. So I get that. Yeah, I get that.
It's a bit of a different pressure though in single seats with that, though, isn't it? If you, let's say, if your dad or your sponsor or somebody, whoever's paying for the racing, and you know you've got that on your mind and you're trying to concentrate on you know, going into turn one flat out and lap one, and you're trying not to biff off someone's your front wing on someone's rear wheel. You're trying to compete with that and against those guys that don't have to worry about it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, GP3 was my worst year, because we were really short of money. We had an investor, I won't name the guy, who was going to put £3.5 million into my career and obviously get a percentage of my future earnings. And that, and you know, I feel myself at the time that that would have taken me to Formula One. I felt like, you know, we were going to do a year in GP3. Then go straight to GP2, which is now F3 and F2. And I knew I was good enough. And, you know, that gave us the money to be able to go into a top team. And when he pulled out, we had to scrape together whatever money we had. So we ended up going with status, and we didn't have any money for crash damage and stuff like that. And it was because I knew we didn't have any money to pay for crashes. Because I was trying to be so careful, I ended up crashing more. Do you know what I mean? It would have been better for me just to go flat out.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're not fully committed, sometimes it's actually way, way worse. And I actually drove, I don't know if you remember, but I drove for that team that you drove for in GP3 the year before. So I know in relative terms how difficult it was to get a real result out of it without, I had years of experience before and still struggled. So for you to just get thrown in there your first year, it was always going to be a pretty tough one, which it proved out to be. Because we were at the test together in Barcelona. I came out with you that once. And you were actually fastest on, I think, the second afternoon, and at that point you were learning the Pirelli tire, so I remember you being able to do it definitely on the one lap, but it was always that, oh, I've got to drive 8-9 seconds off. Yeah, I think you remember saying me something along the lines, that's not made for me, kind of thing.
No, it's not for me.
Like,
it's not
I don't want to drive 9 seconds off the pace. And I was like, well, you're gonna have to
remember that when people used to enter that championship for one race, they used to come from the back of the field having qualified last, and they'd be first or second by the second or third lap, thinking they were Lewis Hamilton. And then you just see them select reverse.
See you, mate.
When 2015, the year where you, I think you might have mentioned it earlier, where you had like 7-8 seconds of deck through the race.
Oh, no, it was sometimes worse than that, Jake. I mean, if you got it wrong in the first couple of laps and you had what so much as one slide, or you pushed a little bit too much in the first lap, you know, but at Barcelona, the first race, I was like 12 seconds off. It was absolutely unbelievable. I mean, I finished stone dead last in my first race in GP3 because I got, you know, they kept on telling me, don't race to start with. And I was like, how are you telling me not to race? And they were like, yeah, just don't do anything. Don't make any moves. You know, don't even bother defending. If someone wants to whiz past you, they'll come back to you because their tires will drop off. And I was thinking, this is crazy, this. I'm just going to push. And I remember making up so many places on lap one and two. And then I was like, oh my God, it was like someone's just sprayed my tires with oil or something. And I was just like, oh my God, I just kept on going backwards and backwards.
Oh yeah, wasn't that the Kvyat one? The championship?
Oh, Ocon.
No, that's the year before when I did it.
Ocon, wasn't it?
I can't remember. I remember a race at Barcelona where Kvyat just selected reverse.
That was the year I did it, Jake, in 2014.
Yeah.
Who won it 2015?
Yeah, both of the Red Bull drivers did. Him and Sainz. Yeah, in 2015, Ocon won.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're right, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
But yeah, so, you know, I was glad to get out of that. And then, obviously, I got a call from Bentley and Team Parker saying, you know, would you like to come and race for us. You know, you won't be a factory driver yet, but they gave us an extremely good deal, which was nothing compared to what we were paying in single seaters. As you guys know, you know how much money it takes to run a car in single seaters. I mean, what's a full budget now for like F3 or something? £1 million?
It's criminal. I mean, to be honest, even when I went into GP3 the year after you in 2016, I think the fee, the sort of roundabout figure for sort of break even for the team was around 700 mark 700 800.
And the problem was is I only paid 200 grand to status for my year, so I suppose it was a great deal, but you know, you get what you pay for at the end of the day. And I remember the next best deal we had was Arden were off, because I topped all the pre-season testing because I was fastest in Abu Dhabi at the end of 14 as well. I don't know if you were there, Nick, weren't you, as well? And I'd smashed...
Yeah, I was on the beach at that time, but you were there.
Yeah, I smoked everything in that. So I was getting loads of nice drives. And the next best was Arden at 350. And I wish I would have managed to raise that because, you know, they were one of the best cars that year.
350?
But I only paid 200 in the end with status.
Yeah.
350 though, the budget.
Yeah, that's so... relatively thinking compared to nowadays. I mean, I think... me and Richie Stanaway did it 2014. And again, we've got to remember that 150, 200 grand is still a massive amount of money, and we're super lucky to have done it. But I think both myself and Richie paid that. And then Alfonso Celis, his family was very wealthy from whatever they were doing and fronted the rest of the bill. Otherwise, I wouldn't have raced. And that's when I soon realised, you know, when you're getting told, oh, you can't crash on this lap or don't push because we've got no more spare front wings, stuff like that, it's like, right, I need to get out. And that's when I looked for my out or whatever to GTs, and it was a weight off my shoulders because there's a whole different world from this Formula One bubble as well. Not that it's not great because Formula One's brilliant, but there's this whole different bubble away from Formula One where you can actually go and earn a really good living and have way more fun.
You know, just on that point, you know, when I talked about this investor that pulled out, when we knew we were scraping the barrel, you know, my dad and I had to have the most difficult conversation, and my mum, dad and me had to have the most difficult conversation and basically say, right, this isn't going to happen. You know, you're not going to be a Formula One driver. And, you know, everyone was in tears because obviously I presumed, you know, I was a bit like Ayrton Senna in a way. I presumed I had a God-given right to be in Formula One, and I genuinely did. So I used to be an arrogant little bugger, and, you know, I suppose you need to be to be good at this game, and I wouldn't say I'm really like that anymore. But basically, you know, we had to have this conversation where we said, right, this isn't going to work, this isn't going to happen, Seb. What do you want to do? And then, you know, we then started making some calls, and then it was actually Team Parker Racing called me and said, you want to come and do this? And I come from finishing 15th, 12th, whatever in GP3, thinking I was shit and thinking I'd lost all my talent. To then, in the first race at British GT against, you know, world-renowned factory drivers, I stuck it on pole by half a second, and I thought, oh, here we go. I've my talent bag still all right. I'm still good. So
it's easy, this.
Yeah.
Brands.
Yeah, Brands Hatch. I set the lap record, still unbeaten to this day. That.
You know, it's because I haven't been.
I was just. You know what? I was just gonna
shut up. That.
But you know the budgets for we talked just mentioned about with GP3 and GP2, you know, it's been 4, 5, 6 years since we were in it, and it's added like another £500,000 on top of it now.
I don't understand, how is that even possible? You're doing the same championship, same races, same cars, pretty much. I know they've changed, but you know, it's the same sort of running budgets. I don't understand why it's going up, and you know, it's all because of demand and supply. Isn't at the end of the day, there's a lot of rich young kids out there now that'll pay whatever it takes, and you know, it's a sad world. And I tell you what, if I had a kid that was a son, I would be putting a football in front of his legs and telling him to kick it, because I would not
want golf clubs
him anywhere to whatever. Do a race.
I mean, I always feel like I'm really privileged to have even started it when I look back.
Yeah,
like just starting in karting, to be able, you know, I had my dad support me karting and into Formula 4, but after that it was like you couldn't do anything about it, and I relied on a lot of people around me. So I kind of, you know, I try not to look at it with regret in a way, and sort of see that there's a lot out there Granted, Formula One is the pinnacle, and you know, in the world, in the eyes of many people, won't know about a lot about Le Mans. That you know, the amount of people that know about Formula One way outweighs the amount of people that know about Le Mans and GT racing and stuff like that. But yeah, I've done a tiny bit of it, but not like to the level you boys have yet. I think it'd probably be coming for me around this year. But I just really look forward to it. It just looks like the racing and GT and sports cars and endurance just looks just so much fun.
You know, I would love to show Formula One fans, you know, some of the highlights of the races we've done, Nick, you know, because they think Formula One's interesting, and you know, some of the stuff we do, especially the sprint race formats, are amazing. You know, with the endurance racing, that it's a very selective sport because you have to really know what you're looking at to be able to see who's where with strategy and stuff like that. But when we do the, you know, the 3-hour races, the sprint races, you know, anywhere between 1 and 3 hours, I mean, they are amazing.
Yeah, I mean, they're really fun. And also, it's not just the racing side, as in on-track action. We'll do a bit of this later on when we're not just doing podcasts. We're trying to develop the channel and do a bit more, you know, video-based, and actually take the fans and guests along with us and let them see from a driver's point of view what the hell actually goes on during a race weekend. But the camaraderie and whatnot between the GT drivers and the level of mutual respect I found
it's really nice.
Like, after, even in South Africa when we were there in December, you know, it doesn't matter who wins, we'll all have a beer together, it's the end of the weekend, have a laugh, you know, chill out, and then move on and see each other next year. Whereas in single seaters, you look at everyone like they've just stood on your dog. And you hate them. It's just really quite toxic, I found, personally.
It's true.
It's true. But GTs is that's the side of people. I think if you've been and you understand, then these super fans are fans for life. But until that, everyone thinks Formula One is the pinnacle, which it is in terms of technological
you know, development and whatnot.
Technological, isn't it? All that stuff, but it's not necessarily pure racing anymore.
Yeah, agreed. You know, so this for me to take that step so early again from, so I took the step early to go into cars, and then I took the step early to get to realise I wasn't going to be a Formula One driver, and jumped early to GTs, and again that really paid off. Within 3 years, I was a factory driver getting paid money by Bentley. So, you know, from thinking my life was over in 2015 to then how it, you know, between 16 and the end of 19 when I got made a factory driver, 3 years, and then, you know, it was all back on track again. And I know it's difficult now with loads of manufacturers pulling out funding, but I think the you know, I am now a factory driver, and once you get that status, it's something that can't be taken away from you. You know, that everyone knows how hard you have to work and how good you have to be in every single way to be a factory driver for any manufacturer. And there's only 6 Bentley boys in the world. And I think there's only ever been some, you know, we looked at a stat the other day, there's only ever been 42 Bentley drivers. So it's a very elite club to be in. So that's why, you know, when you get to race for a manufacturer, you know, opportunities will come. And I know it's going to be tough this year for all of us, but, you know, as I said, it's bums in seats time, and, you know, no one can take away the fact that I've been a Bentley boy. And I've earned that, and hopefully will be again, or, you know, can be with another manufacturer. So just got to keep your head up.
I think that counts for a lot, having that on your CV and just being able to walk into a meeting room and, you know, looking for a driver, if it's somewhere else, somewhere away from Bentley, for example, just for the sake of argument. You know, that's, I'd like to think if I was a team boss, that would jump out to me.
Yeah. 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 Because it gives you a level of kudos, because, you know, you imagine the amount of tests and the amount of data that Bentley have had to look at on me to be able to trust me with one of their cars and trust me to go and fight for championships. You know, and it's all data driven. So you get the drives, yes, if you win championships and races, but, you know, you have to be faultless in terms of your average lap times over both 20 and 50 laps, you know, your average stint times over a whole stint, your fitness, your recovery, your qualifying performances, you know, everything is analysed to the nth degree. And luckily, you know, the year I did with Team Parker in Pro-Am in 2019 was the year that got me that Bentley drive, because I was often out qualifying the other Bentley boys. I was often better in the average stint times. It was me, Jules and Jordan, really, always on the B pillar analysis. And, you know, so I knew I was right in the mix, ready to go, basically. And luckily I made their job very easy because we were racing in the same race. I was in exactly the same car, but I was with a customer team and I did very well. So, you know, it was Team Parker really that got me that drive because they set up a very good car. And, you know, I didn't really have any pressure because we were the customer team. Team Park was a really relaxed environment. And I just went out and did it. And it was those results and data that got me that Bentley drive.
Yeah.
It was like a year-long job interview. Like that.
Yeah. But also, it's not just your on-track performance with manufacturers either. You've got to be personable, which you are. You've got to be good with the customers, which I'm sure you are. You've got to be a good laugh, you know, depending on where you're going. You know, when I went out to China, the guy really liked to have a beer on a night. Well, I don't really drink, and I don't really drink beer. So, you know, you've got to play the game and be really, really good and supportive with all that, those different aspects. And it's all that package that brings it together. As well as being, you know, fast, consistent, good with car setup.
And a lot of it's marketing and PR as well. We worked with Rebecca Jones from VIPR Media, and you know, we had a great laugh with her. And you know, it's about some of the drivers were always going, oh no, I can't be asked. And I was thinking, you know, that's your job. You know, you get there and go and do that PR thing, and just get it done, do it properly, and come back. And it's amazing. I won't name any names, but. You know, overall, in all manufacturers, it's the amount of people that can't be bothered doing that stuff off track, but you don't realize that really, really goes against you if you don't do stuff well and you don't do your PR and marketing stuff, because you know that is, you've got to, you know, a lot of these drivers don't realize, you know, Jake said it, you know, the reason why these manufacturers do this is for marketing. So if you can't be bothered to go to the PR and marketing stuff, then you know that's a big flex against your name.
Yeah. Mm. On that side, mate, carry on.
I was just going to say that, you know, I mean, coming from, I suppose, 2 or 3 years after you, Seb, or a bit longer now, and coming from single seaters to try and get into professional racing, something I'm finding, and I think like what you touched on with saying that you did that year in Pro-Am, is, you know, if I speak from my mindset, I've won a championship in junior racing, I've won races at every level I've been to. And you'd automatically, you know, probably a bit of naivety, think that you could walk into a professional seat in GT endurance racing. And you'd think, you know, that's just, you know, I know I'm good. Surely they've seen I'm good. But in that world, it's like, well, yeah, we know you're good, but are you good in a GT car? And it's like, there's still that question, or a sports car. And it's like, to all intents and purposes, yeah, they think you will be, but they don't know. And kind of, they don't want to, you know, it's like you say, it's all data driven, it's all numbers. And if they think there might be any reason why they shouldn't take you, or you're a bit of a question mark, they won't, and you've got to prove yourself first.
Well, you know, this is a perfect example. I won the British GT Championship in 2017, you know, with Team Parker, backed by M Sport with Bentley. And I just thought I'd walk into the drive the next year. And, you know, I didn't have a call. And I was like, what? And, you know, I pushed and said, you know, I'd love to, you know, love to come and see you. You know, I've got this and that. And they said, yes, Seb, you know, brilliant. Well done for winning British GT, but it's not GT World Challenge, you know, and you know, it's not the same level. And I was going, oh, I was going, the same drivers are in it and stuff. And they were saying it's not the same depth of field. It's, you know, the races are short. You know, are you any good at endurance racing? Blah, blah, blah. And then I did Daytona in the following January and proved I could do all three of those things. And then, you know, halfway through that next year, I then got invited to do one-off races. So I got invited to do Suzuka. I did well there. And Spa 24, halfway through that year as well. And then only once I'd done well in those test races was I then allowed to, you know, was I then given, you know, the contract. And that was a great day in the office, you know, to have a contract where you get paid to drive a racing car is a very big moment.
Yeah, it's gold dust, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's huge. And yeah, it doesn't come a lot across. Like you say, there's not many drivers, I think, with BMW, that maybe 8 to 10 GT drivers. Obviously, you've got your Formula E guys and you've got the drivers that specialised in DTM until this year. But it's a very elite and privileged group to be able to get to that sort of, you know, stage. So it took me from single seaters as well 2-3 years of proving myself, because when I rocked up in a Carrera Cup car, no one had a clue. They said, oh yeah, I know you've done a single seater, but you won't be good in one of these straight away. And to be fair, they were right, and I struggled a little bit.
I thought you were going to say they were wrong.
No, they were right. The first half of the year in 2016, jumping from, you know, GP2 and doing some F1 testing to a Carrera Cup car with no ABS, no grip, no traction control. I struggled for the first half a year, and then
it's the weight as well of the car, isn't it? You know, you have to load the car up before you turn a GT. So when you're going into a corner, you've got to give it a bit of that, and then just go right. Okay, there's some weight come across. I'll now turn.
Yeah, I did this. I did that. In Oschersleben, my first test. You know the quick chicane.
Yeah.
I was like building up, and I was like at maybe half a second off the reference, and I was like, oh, I'm missing the time there. So I fired it in there like a single superman. I had the biggest spin. I was just, <"Whoa!" laughs> and I was like, oh, okay, maybe I don't do it like that then. So it's crack on, Alex. It'd be interesting to hear what you've got to say about weight transfer from bikes. Yeah.
I was just going to say, like, because Jake's maybe making that transition from single seaters to having a roof over his head. Like, what were the biggest, for Seb and Nick, you know, what were the biggest, like, changes you two had to make to your driving styles to be able to get the most out of something, well, with a roof over your head?
Well, but basically, with the GT3 cars, the biggest issue I had was that I couldn't find time on braking because I was always last to late breakers. I mean, you know, I'm not good at many things, but I've got a set of bollocks between my legs. So let's put it that way. So, I found that very difficult. And, you know, as I said about the Daytona car, I like coming out of corners sideways. I think I would have been very good in the 80s myself, both on the dance floor and on the racetrack. but you know, because it was all about traction control and your TC settings and ABS, I found it really held me back. And I found, I, you know, still to this day, it actually takes a while to be able to learn how to hustle a car with all those assists and sort of learn to drive with those assists. And then you can really start hustling. And I remember looking at some of Jules Gounon's qualifying laps, and, you know, he was absolutely hustling it, and he was completely sideways in some places, but because he was on the power and the TC was cutting and then the TC was ready to kick in, he would learn to drive around the TC and the ABS while the thing was going completely sideways. And it took me a while to learn that, to be honest.
Yeah, I'd say the same thing. ABS and TC, it's about learning how you can most extract the lap time using those. I mean, it depends on which car. Obviously, I drive a BMW M6 and Seb drove the Bentley Continental, and each of those have different type of ABS settings, mapping settings, traction control settings. And it's about whatever car Jake jumps into to just go and try and come out of a corner and sit in the TC and get used to how that feels. That's what I tended to do with the M6 anyways, go out of a corner and get sideways and forget the lap and just sit in it and feel how I could drive around it. So I'm able to sit in it, particularly when the tire gets older, but making the most out of lap time. And once I got that, then I became fast.
Yeah, what I found in the Bentley is that you can't really feel where you know, sometimes it would have a big snap here and there. And I was wondering, you know, is this me on the edge of grip or is it the TC cutting? So when I then got really confident, I used to go out on my first couple of laps and just turn the TC completely off. And I know that's, you know, it's really, you know, if Bentley found that out, I was doing that, they'd probably go mad because, you know, it's very unsafe. But that I needed to just know, you know, is it me wheel spinning this car or is it the TC? And I just used to go out of the box, turn it off or right down and just nail it and just feel where the grip was. Because I find it, you know, a lot of people can get up to speed, you know, to be half a second off quite quickly. But once you're within that half a second of pole, it's that last half a second, which is then about the finesse of tuning the TC and knowing if you are on the edge of grip or not.
Yeah. So you like almost do that to get the feeling of the car. Because like, do you find it gives you like a numb sensation?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. You sometimes you come out of a corner and the TC will be cutting, but you don't know if that's because you've had a little slide and the TC is sort of catching up with that slide and it then starts cutting you. Or you don't know if your wheels are actually still spinning, and it's, you know, it's hard. It takes a long time. I say years to really learn a car to know what it's doing and when with regards to all these systems and things like that.
Nah, completely.
Can't wait.
I've never heard someone sound so positive about it.
the only time other than the Autosport Award where you drive the GT car and the DTM car. Only time I've ever driven a car with a roof over my head was actually 2014. I did a VLM race with BMW actually.
Yeah.
And was in that 235R. You know, it's a road car. It's still got the DSG gear selector in it. You know,
the hardest drive took GT3 that, because it's bouncing up and down and all the time, isn't it?
Hey, yeah, it's so. Hey,
I just remember, you know, like the BLM races, you don't get any laps on the Nordschleife. Was it? Oh, there he is. It's gone. Yeah, you know, like on the Nordschleife, you don't get any practice, do you, on the BLN, really?
No.
You just turn up, you go on the Grand Prix track the previous day and you turn up. And I remember going out for my first laps on the BLN track and I was on slicks and it started raining on the Nordschleife.
It always does. I've never driven a race in a Nordschleife where it's just been lovely and dry all weekend. Have you, Nick?
No. You always go into one corner flat out on slicks and it's raining. You're like, oh no,
please. Yeah, best thing in that case though was, because it was still had all the normal stuff in, it was reliant on the, you know, just the car's like anti-fog for the windscreen that you would do in your road car in the morning. It failed. So I couldn't see a thing. So I'm taking all the belts off in the car. I shouldn't be really saying this, but loosened all the belts off. Wind the window down, and I had to stick my head out the window to get back to the pits because I couldn't see a thing. So that's my only experience of a GT car. Well, it's not really a GT car, is it? But you know, so I can't wait for more of that, basically.
You'll love it, mate. You'll love it. And Seb, with the obviously not just racing wise, you've done a bit on TV, haven't you, mate?
Yeah, I'm coming out on TV on Sunday as well, on Valentine's Day. So I've got another. It's going on BBC One. I've got to have basically a date with my ex-girlfriend, like completely out of the blue. And on each plate, they write you a question for starter, main course and dessert. So like when I get my starter, I take my napkin off my plate and then it's got a question on that plate of what she wants to actually really ask you. So mine was, why did he cheat on me? And I was like, oh God, here we go.
Here we go.
Mate. Which I obviously denied.
There's lots of wine on the table. Was there lots of wine on the table?
There was, yeah. I needed a lot of wine to get me through that. But yeah, I did Celebs Go Dating, which was really good fun. It was a complete change for motor racing, because you know we're haggling to get free drives and whatnot. And then I said to this production company when they spoke to me, they said, what's the fee? And they said, how does 40 grand sound? And I went, fucking hell, to do some TV.
Yeah, double it.
Yeah. So you know, we obviously then did some negotiating, and you know, I wasn't earning any money at the time, so I was like, this is a joke. I was like, what, for a month's filming? The money was very good, but B, it raised my profile massively, and actually it brought Bentley really liked the fact I did it, because it brought a different audience to Bentley Motorsport, and that, you know, we ended up getting a lot of fans off the back of it, people that liked seeing me on TV and then wanted to follow that journey, and we, you know, they ended up getting a load of new fans. So it's, you know, I always like doing the random TV stuff, because you know it brings more people aware of what I'm doing, really, and what GT and endurance racing is all about. So it's been really good. So you know, this show, again, it will get a few million viewers, and I'm sure my profile will pick up again, which also helps with sponsors and things like that. So yeah, you know, it's
loads of Instagram followers.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, and it does help. You know, it definitely helps. And one of the main things sponsors look for now is social media activation. And you know, if you've got no followers and yet you ain't got a blue tick, then they're not interested.
No, it's mad how that actually works. The blue tick is a massive thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it works for
come along. I'll tell you what, lads, good job we got him on the podcast first, isn't it then?
Yeah, exactly. We got a world exclusive then. I didn't know he was gonna be on TV. So that's pretty cool. You can shout out our channel when you're
Miller.
Yeah, well, it'll be going on. It's going on iPlayer on Sunday, and then it'll be going on BBC One at prime time in the next couple of weeks. So that'll be when it really. So the iPlayer thing, you know, it's just going to be a slow release sort of thing. But then when it goes on BBC One, I mean, that'll be massive.
So when did you do your first TV show then?
I did it. So again, this all came off the back of winning British GT. So then, I got approached by Channel 4, the producers there, and they said, you know, we've seen you just won this massive championship. They saw it in the newspaper, because you know. My PR guy did a really good job, mate. You know, it got in the Daily Mail and loads of other stuff. And then they literally called me up and asked me to come down to London, because I just won this British Championship for Bentley. And they thought I was a Bentley boy at the time, and I didn't tell them otherwise. So it all came from that, really. And that was in 2018, I think I did that, the year after winning British GT. So those were a great couple of years in all aspects. Not a care in the world then.
No, it's good. It's good, mate. And well, I think we should wrap it up there. We've talked about everything here, there and everywhere, both racing and then the celebrity world. We can all go and get on with our days and drink a load of coffee. So thank you very much for coming on, Seb. Appreciate it.
No, I really enjoyed that, boys. And let me know when it's coming out and I'll promote the shit out of it.
Yeah, that's what we like to hear. So with my professional hat on, I'd just like to thank the guests and listeners. Make sure, obviously, you follow Seb and his new journey on the reality TV. Give him all those likes on the photos. And, of course, follow the HYM podcast on all social media channels as well. Hope to see and hear you all again soon, or hear from you all again soon. And, yeah, get in the comments. Any more questions for Seb, we can ask him and get him back on, I'm sure, at a later date.
Thank you for having me, guys, and thanks everyone for listening. Much appreciated, and I hope to be given the honour of being invited back soon.
Yeah, no, for sure you will, mate. Thanks again. See ya.
Nice one to you, sir.